So don't hesitate if you have any questions. Welcome to part two of the first class, then the introductory class on the history of the BBC. And with a bit of luck, I have somewhere another PowerPoint number two. Okay, it's not there. Okay, it must be here. Okay, just bear with me. Nope, it's on. Let's close that one and see if I can find another one. There you go. Diaporama. À partir du début. Nope. Back to Zoom. Partager l'écran. There you go. Right, okay, so again, don't hesitate if you have a question to put it on the chat. I'll just check my MP3 recorder is working. Yes, it is. My next bit is what questions need to be asked about the history of the BBC. Very much a historian's question, that. Now, it sounds a bit obscure, and like I said, the reason that I'm looking at it like this is that you can easily get lots of facts about different events in the BBC. So I'm not, of course I'm going to give you plenty of facts, but that's not my main aim. My main aim is to look at how does it all come together? What does the BBC represent? Is the BBC a bit like the health service? So the BBC is a public service, the health service is a public service. The health service has transformed millions of people's lives. In 1945, we got free doctors, free dentists, free glasses. People lived longer, people were happier. Even though, you know, sometimes the healthcare is not so good, the fact that even that there was psychological help or even psychiatric support at some moment, it was better than before. In the 1930s, my grandparents, they would call the doctor if a child was ill, even if they had nothing, that meant they were not going to eat anything that week. But if an adult was ill, they didn't call the doctor, it's too expensive. So the National Health Service transformed people. Can we look at the BBC in a similar way? Did it transform and enrich people's lives, the enchantment of everyday life? Or was it a state's information service with lots of propaganda involved more to be frowned on, the mass media telling people what to think and stopping people from being free? Which of these are true? Are they both a bit true? Are neither of them true? That's the kind of question we're looking at. I'm expecting you to have a headache by the end of the day. Okay, so what questions need to be asked about the BBC? The BBC, one of the oldest and biggest national broadcasters and a symbol of British influence in the world. Although the Olympic opening ceremony in 2012... a key opportunity to present the best of British to an audience of hundreds of millions, chose to structure its story of British pride around the Industrial Revolution, the National Health Service, and popular music, the BBC might well have found its way into this canon. Even today, in 2020, 62% of UK citizens have a positive opinion of the BBC, and only 18% a negative one. This is, appears to me to be quite impressive. First of all, there's a lot of competition, Netflix and so on. And also, anything connected with the government is usually unpopular these days. And so 62% is really quite impressive. Studying the history of the BBC has to be a daunting prospect. Over the 75 years, over a million hours of programmes. But producer Hugh Weldon liked to say that the BBC was only the sum of its programmes. So what can we do with that? Well, first of all, we're fortunate that a wide selection of work survives, in particular in television drama, comedy and documentary. Thousands of programmes can be accessed free online on YouTube. And the entire scheduled listings of radio and television from the 1920s on are now available to browse. Now, you don't have time to do this very much, but if you go to the BBC Genome Project, it can be very interesting. Choose a date at random, you know, the 23rd of March, and look at 1923, 1933, 1943, it will take you 20 minutes to look at, and you can have a feeling for the sort of programs which were important for them. Now, because the archive is so huge, we cannot say, oh, well, the programs speak for themselves. There's no need for theory or analysis. The archives will speak for themselves because they're too big. And so it is clear that you have to ask questions of the archives, and which questions are made a priority depends, as always, on the motivations of the historians. And what I'm going to do now is look at different kinds of questions which different kinds of scholars might ask. First of all, political analysts, and then different kinds of historians. So first of all, general political interrogation. Since the BBC is so universally a symbol of Britishness, you can imagine patriotic historians asking, why did the BBC get it right? On the other hand, you can think of radical political thinkers looking at this very differently. As early as 1937, a newspaper, The Left Review, which was a left-wing review, secret. They published a pamphlet entitled The BBC Exposed, which denounced the pro-capitalist values of the BBC and insisted that the Board of Governors, which runs the BBC, should really be chosen among representatives of trade unions, since at the time trade unions had many, many millions of members. It seemed to them more democratic than the Board of Governors, who were chosen really from the elites. So that is the a question which might be asked by political analysts. Other kinds of political analysis will ask different questions. 80 years later, in 2016, Kate Murphy wrote this book, Behind the Wireless: A History of Early Women at the BBC. She was inspired by ideas of feminism, and she wanted to know why we knew so little about women in the early BBC. And this is what she said. One of the reasons why the image of the BBC is so masculine is because of the huge number of memoirs written by former employees, all men. It is these accounts which form the background of most research. And so she said, well, you know, where can we find the women who were there at the beginning of the BBC? And she found lots of them. Some of them had very good jobs, like Hilda Matheson, who was really a top manager chosen by John Reith. But also she found a lot of people making programmes, even though on paper the job of the woman was secretary. Because you could only get a job as a secretary. But then when you were in the creative team, if you were lucky, you worked with a man who could see that you were really good at this and would allow you to produce programmes. And it was just life that they would never hire you as a producer, even though you were actually producing the programmes. And so there were all sorts of things she understood. But this was possible because she began with the question. She began with the question, where are the women hidden? If she had begun with the archive, she would never have seen them, because the archive is full of memoirs of men. So that's just to show how important the questions are. And I will come back to women again and again. General analysts of media power will suggest other questions. The great French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu wrote a book called Sur la Télévision. And he concentrated on the news and what it's for. Am I doing this? These in order? Yes. He concentrated on the news, and he emphasised how the spotlight on the spectacular and on the event obscures truths about society. Everyday suffering in the workplace does not appear on the news. Everyday suffering in the family does not appear on the news. But when workers go on strike, this is news. The construction of what is news and what is not news has an ideological and political effect. Laura Mulvey, another theoretician, explored the question of how women are objectified in film and in narrative television. Her concept of the male gaze, le regard masculin, is particularly useful when looking at entertainment programmes. And in my chapter on popular music, I look at how women are presented on Top of the Pops. So that's another media theorists, political analysts or media theorists have their questions to ask of the history of the BBC. Meanwhile, a Marxist commentator, such as John Molyneux, will propose questions such as the following to help understand the place of television in class society. This is what John Molyneux says. He says, why do TV companies produce The Apprentice, you know, how to become the best top manager, and Dragon's Den, how to become a perfect small businessman? Why do they produce these, and why do they never produce programmes how to be a good trade union representative? Why, another question, why does almost everyone in EastEnders own a small business? Why on the news do they always say, do they always talk about the stock market going up as if this is good for everybody? And if the media are only giving people what they want, then why do people want what they want? Those are some of the general political science questions which might be asked of the history of the BBC. Let us move on to historians and begin with political historians. Political history is about what governments do. What decisions do governments make, and what difference does it make? Now, radio and television broadcasting hold a particular place in the policy priorities of democratic states. Certainly, no prime minister can ever say, I don't care what the BBC does. The BBC is huge. It's a central problem. What kind of questions would the political historian put forward? Well, they might ask, by what mechanisms did governments influence the BBC, given its nominal independence? How successful was this influencing? To what extent can BBC programmes in wartime or crisis time be considered to constitute propaganda? Because certainly the BBC was very important to people. Churchill's radio speeches during the Second World War were an extremely innovative and powerful means of persuading people. And the role of the BBC during the Suez Crisis in 1956 was also tremendously important. More questions from the political historian. How was the relationship between BBC and the government affected by a change from Conservative to Labour or vice versa? That sort of question. Sometimes prime ministers or other politicians were rather unhappy with the BBC. Here is a recent book written by Jean Seaton talking about the BBC and the Nation, 1974 to 1987. And the title is a quotation from a Conservative minister who said, the BBC is full of pinkos and traitors. C'est bourré de gauchistes et de traîtres. This is very unlikely to be true, but it's very interesting to see that the Conservative ministers really saw it in that way and were very, very angry with the BBC. And we will be looking, and you'll find in the books, a few examples of when the government was unhappy with the BBC. Again, there was probably an example every year, but we choose five or six symbolic examples because we need to reduce the number of examples. Another example, fascinating example, is this one. This is a documentary which the BBC produced in 1971. The Conservatives had just won the election and the Labour Party were no longer in government. So they made this documentary about the Labour leadership and they interviewed the Labour leadership without telling them what kind of documentary it was. And the title of the documentary was Yesterday's Men. You know, the Labour leadership are Yesterday's Men. So obviously this cannot be considered to be in any way neutral. But what is most fascinating about this is that if you go today to the BBC website, they have an article on this and they say, today we recognise that this was not neutral broadcasting and we're rather ashamed of it. So that's quite interesting example. Naturally enough, the government and the BBC came into some conflict, and I will come back to this on the question of Northern Ireland, covering the troubles. How did the media and how did the BBC present the conflict in Northern Ireland to British people? And the BBC and other broadcasters have been very heavily criticised for how they presented the Northern Ireland question. Nevertheless, political history does not only deal with the relationship of the BBC to the government. Another important part of political history is the relationship between BBC management and trade unions. Trade unions were able to protect their members' interest by not allowing BBC management to do what they want. One example was the Musicians' Union. The Musicians' Union, they were one of their biggest employers, was the BBC. But they had a problem. They said, if BBC, this is in the 50s and 60s and 70s, if the BBC play records all day, we're not going to have much work as live musicians. And so they said to the BBC, we will tell our members to work for you if you agree that you will only play 4 hours of records a day, for example. I can't remember the exact numbers. So that was one of the moments when the trade unions came up. Okay, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. I want to look at institutional history. Institutional history is important, and institutional history is probably the most common one you see around, where the book, the historian, looks at, you know, who was the new leadership, what decisions did they make, what new departments did they establish, what were their priorities, how did they relate to government. This is institutional history, and certainly Asa Briggs, in his 5-volume history of British broadcasting, concentrated on institutional history. An institutional history of the BBC is indispensable because it allows us to understand the grammar of the BBC. How much pressure was there on the creative teams making the programmes? How much room for manoeuvre did they have? Who were the director generals? Who appointed them and why? What policies did they implement? What services did they establish? What priorities did they push? Between 1927 and 1995, there were 12 director generals, all of them men. Indeed, there, even up to today, 2021, there has never been a woman director general. Contrairement à la France, où la directrice de France Télévision est une femme. J'ai oublié son nom. So those are the 5 volumes of Asa Briggs' Great History. Each of the director generals, and institutional history would explain to us, had their own mark that they left on the BBC, and certainly more than any other was that of John Reith. When he became director general, there were very few rules and traditions as to how public broadcasting should function. They'd never done it before. People were extremely excited to work for radio. You have to, you know, it was an exciting new industry. We're going to allow people can talk and millions of people can listen to them. It's incredible. I told my grandma and she didn't believe it. I'm imagining myself as a radio technician in the 1920s. If he told his grandma that it was a system where one person could talk to 10 million, his grandma would probably say, oh, you stop talking nonsense. That's impossible. It was really very, very avant-garde. Now, John Reith did have his particular impact. He had Presbyterian religious views. His personal opinion on what kind of broadcasting was appropriate for Sunday was very strong. For year after year after year, there were no programmes in the morning because people should be at church. And in the afternoon, no popular music, only classical music, and then a programme about charity. And this was called the Reith Sunday. That's not an official name, it's an informal name for it. The Reith Sunday was a very serious religious and classical Sunday. He played every Sunday a cantata from Bach. Yeah. Not any popular music, not any classical music. And he was the boss, so they did it like that. So obviously his own opinion about how important Sunday was had a big influence on the BBC. But another thing which had a big influence on the BBC was John Reith's opinion on recruiting women. Because unlike most elite men of his time, he thought that women were some of the best leaders for broadcasting. And he went out personally and found Hilda Matheson and gave her the job as first director of talks Every day there was a talk or two, a conférence, à la radio, very, very varied subjects. And he said, the person we need to be the top boss of this is Hilda Matheson. This is very, very surprising for a gentleman at his time. Although, as I already mentioned, in other ways, he was extremely conservative. So, now, other director generals also had their priorities, and I will be doing a whole class just about the director generals. But they no doubt had less personal power, since the traditions of the job and the increasing number of committees dealing with one or other aspect of the workings of the BBC imposed constraints. So what other questions would an institutional approach to British history underline? Well, when the leadership of the BBC decides to establish a new service or a new department, these new departments or new services can make a real difference to the history of the BBC. Let me give you an example. In 1926, this is a book about this committee. In 1926, John Reith established the BBC Advisory Committee on Spoken English. And this establishment reflected the worries in educated and influential circles about the decline of proper English. And this committee was to be sure that there was no decline of proper English. No regional accents, please. No. No working class grammar. No. So it was a very much an elitist thing. John Reith explained, this is what he said, happily for us, the officials of our broadcasting company have been well chosen and are all educated and refined men and women who use cultivated language to which it is a pleasure to listen. Unlike in America, the very tones of our own announcers' voices are an indication of a background of education and culture. I can't really do the bourgeois accent, I was just trying. And so you can see this is a very much a traditional view of language, and certainly 50 years later in the 1970s, regional accents were fine. And so on. So this is something which changed. And indeed, what is fascinating about this committee is that it was suspended during the war, during the Second World War. That's not surprising. Most things were suspended during the Second World War. The television, for example, was suspended during the Second World War. But in 1945, they could have re-established it, and they decided not to. They decided to forget it forever. Now, this is highly political, because in the 1930s, old-fashioned elitism still had a huge influence, but in order to win the war, the British government promised the population, in future the ordinary people will be important, there will be free doctors, lots of social housing, free dentists, free glasses, money. If you're unemployed there will be money from the government, ordinary people are going to be much more important. We call this the welfare state, which is not a very good expression, but that's what it is. And this ordinary people are going to be much more important included, we cannot put back this idea that we don't want any working class people on the radio. So it reflects and also participates in a major social change. The democratic spirit of the welfare state and the rising importance of individual expression in public space killed off this committee. So this is an institutional change, the establishment of this committee and the abolition of this committee, but it transforms the programmes, and it's both a reflection of social change and an accelerator of social change. Because of course once they started having regional accents on the television, on the radio, people listening to the radio hear regional accents, and that encourages them to think, oh well, you know, maybe it's fine for people to have different accents. Maybe BBC English or the Queen's English is not really so superior after all. Another example of a service established which made a big difference in 1936, for the first time, against the opinion of John Reith, they established the first audience research section. I already mentioned that Reith had famously said, we don't need to ask people what they want. They don't know what they want, or they certainly don't know what they need. So that's simple, yeah? And so audience research, which is asking listeners what they think of the programmes, John Reith didn't like this idea at all. It's a little bit democratic, isn't it? It sounds a little bit democratic. And so the establishment of this was the beginning of taking into account the opinions of the listeners. Now, of course, taking into account the opinions of listeners and viewers was more important after later on when there was competition from commercial television. Because if the viewers don't like your programme, they'll go and watch the commercial television instead. And the government will be shouting, hey, we pay all this money for you and you don't have many viewers yet. So after there was competition, it was automatic to look at the listeners and viewers' views. But before that, it was an option. Fascinating enough, Robert Silvey, the gentleman who was the manager of the first BBC audience research, was recruited in the traditional way of the elite of the 1930s. They invited him to lunch at a gentleman's club. No ladies allowed, of course. They had lunch with him and talked about the war and what kind of war he'd had and what kind of family he came from. Never mentioned the job, and gave him the job 3 days later. This is how the elite worked in the olden days. So, of course, you can imagine that somebody from the working class or a woman had no chance at all, because they would never even be invited. Things, of course, have changed. Today, in 2021, if there was a job for head of BBC audience research, it would be advertised in the newspaper with the salary, and at the bottom of the advert it would say, applications from women and ethnic minorities are particularly welcome. That's how 2021 is different from 1936. One more important institutional change. In 1967, the Director General of the BBC decided to transform radio. They abolished the three old stations, the Home Service, the Light Programme and the Third Programme. Abolished it. Replace it with Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 3, Radio 4. And number one, yeah, Radio 1, I mean, it sounds like the most important, doesn't it? Radio 1. Radio 1 was only today's music. All day music, only today's music. Completely different from what they had done before. They had defeated the pirate radios, and the way that they defeated the pirate radios was by hiring all their DJs. Well, first of all, the government managed to use the law to stop the pirate radios. I will come back to this later. And secondly, they hired all DJs. And this is an interesting moment, because the BBC hired DJs mostly from the pirate radios. And this was 1967 and Radio 1. Radio 1 was modern. This was going to be rock music all day. How to be modern, young, up to the presenters are relatively young. How to be modern, up to date. This is the revolution, this is the cultural revolution. The old world is when we are the modern world. And here are all the BBC One presenters in 1967. And I was very shocked. Because I'm not, you know, I have some experience. I was expecting 20 men and 3 women. There were zero women. Zero women. And that, I thought that was particularly shocking, because Radio One was not supposed to represent tradition. Radio 1 was supposed to present rock and roll, modernity, moving forward, a new world. But it seems that it was not necessary to include women at that time. And the very first woman disc jockey on Radio 1, Annie Nightingale, it's a fabulous story. And she just... Elisa Arsely, pendant des semaines et des mois, jusqu'à ce qu'elle ait un boulot, quoi. Mais vraiment, Arsely, d'une façon obsessionnelle. Well, that was what was necessary at the time to get. The beautiful side of this story is that Annie Nightingale today is 80 years old, and she is still a disc jockey on Radio 1, playing the latest new music for young people. So I think that's a little bit of revenge for the very unequal society we had back then. I'm not going to look at that. What other kinds of history might have questions to ask about the BBC? Well, certainly one of them would be social history. Social history is one of the great currents which helped to pull history out of the excessive concentration on great men and great events. In Britain, the golden age of social history was during the post-war boom, when E.P. Thompson, Eric Hobsbawm and Christopher Hill were producing their most renowned works. The Collins Dictionary defines social history as a view of historical events seen in terms of social trends. And so our question might be, how does social change affect broadcasting, and how does broadcasting affect social change? So what kind of specific questions might this give? Well, over the 70 years, or 73 years, from 1922 to 1995, the audiences of the BBC have changed, their lives have changed, and their attitudes have changed, no doubt more quickly than in any previous century. Houses became bigger and families smaller. There was a huge rise in geographical mobility and an intensification of urbanisation. We saw more autonomy for young people, the end of single-sex education, more ethnic diversity, more possessions for most of the population, much more education for the masses, far less state intervention in people's personal lives, and a relative relaxation of strict distinctions between social classes in clothing and in cultural consumption. Life expectancy rose hugely, average working hours per week fell, dangerous physical work became considerably rarer. There was a gradual decline in deference and in religiosity, and a gradual rise in the importance of the individual personality and in consumer choice. The productions of the BBC reflect these changes. The productions tell stories about these changes, presenting our lives to ourselves, and the productions express anxiety or satisfaction about these changes. The social historian could ask questions about the interaction between changing social structures and broadcasting. For example, we often hear talk about a family programme. This is a family programme. But a family programme on the radio in 1930 is addressed to a larger family in a smaller lodging than a family programme on television in the 1980s. In 2021, we might ask, does that exist anymore, a family programme, when even in working class families, there is often a screen for every person? Has the family programme disappeared forever? I don't know, it's not my period. This is what, the old joke, how many historians do you need to change a light bulb? And the answer is, sorry, it's not my period. Because we're not expected to know anything outside our period. So the imagined audience, which is a 1930s family, is very different from the 1980s family. Ideas of what might bring consensus in a family have been completely transformed between these two dates. By the 1980s, it is expected, for instance, that musical tastes will differ widely between parents and their children, which was far less the case in 1930. And even today, this is a social phenomenon which is fascinating. If you take a 15-year-old child, it might not be too surprising to see them liking the same television series as their mother. But loving the same popular music is much more unlikely. Why? Fortunately, that is not a question for us, because we're concentrating on the history of the BBC. Those were a few reflections on social history, but another kind of history which might give us some questions to ask about the BBC is the history of technology. Political history and social history represent huge swathes of historical scholarship, whereas the history of technology is a smaller field. The history of broadcasting is closely bound up with the history of technology, but what we are interested in here is not how the machines work. A technician would be very interested in one of the big moments of the history of radio technology is the invention of the transistor. Now, a technician is interested in how a transistor works. Somebody who writes on the history of technology is not really interested in how a transistor works, but on what difference does it make to the BBC when the transistor is invented. Sometimes technological changes are decisive, and I'm going to give you just a couple of examples. In the 1950s, as the number of people watching television, the number of television licenses being sold rose very, very quickly, many people in the BBC radio were getting a bit depressed. is television going to replace radio? Video killed the radio star, etc. Two technological advances saved radio. The first was that sound quality for listening to music was considerably better on radio than on television. After experiments carried out from 1958, the first regular BBC transmissions in stereo on FM began on the BBC's third programme network in August 1962. Over the next 10 years, the technology was improved and stereo became the norm for radio broadcasting, but not for the television for a very long time. It was partly as a result of this emerging advantage for radio that BBC radio programming reoriented itself in 1967, centred around music. Radio 1 played recent pop and rock, Radio 2 popular and variety music in general, while Radio 3 concentrated on classical and opera, although jazz was later added to Radio 3 when jazz stopped being widely popular music and became an elite taste. It was added to Radio 3, which is fascinating. The second huge technological change which saved the radio was the transistor. You have here an example of a radio before the transistor. Now, I'm afraid I should have got a photograph where you could see how big it is. But I'm pretty certain that it doesn't have batteries. You have to plug it in. So the radio's two advantages over the television were the fact that it's easy to do something else while listening and that you can move it around a little bit. The invention of transistors reduced hugely the weight and size of radios, and so the types of workplace or leisure situation which they could be used. The first transistor radio went on sale in 1954, and the cheaper Sony TR-63, which is not this one, was released in 1967. Faced with different audiences now to be found in their cars, vans, workshops, in the park or at the seaside, programmes tended to adapt accordingly. How were programmes changed to match the mobile audience? The question is worth answering. Certainly the lives of taxi drivers, lorry drivers, people who worked in small workshops were massively transformed by the transistor radio, which also allowed car radios. If you can imagine, if you talk to lorry drivers, they can't imagine what it was like to be a lorry driver without the radio. It goes without saying that there's no other way of listening to things besides the radio at the time. So huge social changes thanks to a little technology. Other examples: at the beginning, television programmes could never be recorded. So if they had the Wednesday play, they had a theatre play on the television, and it was on Thursday, and then there was a repeat on Sunday, the actors came back to the studio to play the play again on the Sunday. It couldn't be recorded. And indeed, when they got the technology which allowed it to be recorded, they had to negotiate with the trade unions. Because the trade unions said, well, you know, if our members, the actors, if they play a play, and then you put it five times on the television, well, there'll be much less work for actors. And so they had an agreement, only once in a year, only once in the first year, only twice in the first 5 years, something like that. That's not the exact figures, but something like that. It had a social thing. Another example, at the beginning, the technology did not allow people to record outside. So radio news was all from the studio. And so those are technological changes which changed people's lives. I'm still looking at more kinds of history. I have a few more kinds of history. History of arts. It might not be obvious how the history of art and the methods of history of art, the priorities of the history of art, the questions of history of art would apply to the history of the BBC. But let me show you. The history of art traditionally looks, first of all, at influences between artists. You know, what did Mozart take from the artist before him, and what did he transmit to the artists after him? That kind of thing, yeah. And also, a very important part of the history of art is the history of forms. For example, how did the symphony develop? how did the alto triptych develop? You know, what is the first time we can say, oh, that's a symphony? And how did the form of the symphony change? What? How did the rules change? So how did the symphony, the alto triptych, the novel, the cathedral, or the sonnet slowly develop as forms of artistic product? When did key changes or key innovations come into effect? And these are questions which mutatis mutandis you can apply to the productions of television or of radio. Because in the 1920s, when radio was on its up, they had to invent everything. They had to invent the quiz show. They had to invent the radio talk, because speakers were used to speaking without microphones to a big room of 500 people. And if you're on the radio, you must not speak like that. You must not speak to, as if you're speaking to it. So they had to invent the interview. At the beginning, it doesn't sound like you have to invent an interview. You do. At the beginning, they said, oh, well, we better write down the questions, and then you write down your answers, and I'll read the questions, and you read the answers. For many years, all interviews on the BBC radio were scripted. Now, it sounds kind of silly to us today, but everything has to be invented. They had to invent the radio play. People knew a lot, well, the elite in particular, knew a lot about the theatre. They loved the theatre, but they had to invent the radio play. How do you do a radio play? Well, they asked people to send them radio plays, but most of the scripts they received were useless, because they didn't work for radio. You have to be able to see. And people were thinking, well, how can we do, what do we need to do? And there's lots of rules. For example, you must make sure that characters do not have similar voices. It's kind of obvious, but yeah. One of my favorite examples is that one of the first radio plays to be successful was a story which happened down a coal mine. And the electricity, in the story, the electricity collapses and doesn't work. And so all the action takes place in the dark. And so it's perfect for a radio play. I thought that was a pretty clever way of doing it. Similarly, the sitcom. The sitcom has to be developed. And certain inventions, for example, what we call canned laughter. You know, in a lot of sitcoms, every time something funny happens, you hear laughter like in Friends. This idea had to be invented. To use kin laughter, the interview, the disc jockey, the quiz show, the radio play, or the news bulletin all had to be invented. And some of the resistances at the beginning were very interesting. At the beginning, on the BBC, the newsreader had to wear a formal suit, not just a suit, a formal suit, what we call black tie, and smoking. And they insisted that all the newsreader, because he said just like when you if you work on the telephone, your boss says you must smile when you're talking on the telephone, because people can tell. I don't know if it's true or not, but in any case, the head of the BBC said, you know, we need people in formal dress. And when they did radio plays, the characters acted with costume and makeup, because they were actors from the theatre, and to feel in the situation, that's what they needed to do. There's a lot of fascinating examples. Another example, on the top left, you have the first ever disc jockey in the world, Christopher Stone, on BBC Radio at the time. And interestingly enough, he's not. He doesn't look. He doesn't look like a typical disc jockey from later, and the other one does. Interestingly enough, in the 60s and the 70s. They wanted young disc jockeys. But later on, this didn't seem to matter so much. Well, as you know, the Rolling Stones are still on stage, and, spoiler, they're not young anymore. So, how to do disc jockeying? All of these things had to be invented. And so these are aspects, really, if you like, of the history of art. That is, they are the history of production forms, the history of creative forms. And here is the picture of Annie Nightingale, the first woman disc jockey on the BBC. She had great difficulty getting the job, I mentioned, and even after that, there was a lot of prejudice. For example, for many years, she was only allowed to broadcast on Sundays, because in the opinion of the managers of the BBC, during the week, most of the listeners were housewives, and housewives didn't want to listen to women. They wanted to listen to substitutes for their husbands. I'm not making this up. They really said this. It's quite impressive. Now, this is very, very interesting because it not only is it obviously horribly sexist, but also it was really based on prejudice and not on information, because in reality, housewives were not the majority of the audience. There were hundreds of thousands of taxi drivers, lorry drivers, sales representatives, plumbers. My father was a gas fitter in the 1960s. I had to go into people's houses, you know, and install the gas pipes under the floor. So they would usually leave him alone for several hours, yeah. And so he could have a transistor radio. That was absolutely fine, because he was in somebody's homes. Whereas very often, if you work in a factory, or a small workshop, you could have a radio, but very often the boss didn't want you to have a radio because they thought you wouldn't concentrate. My first job, I have to tell you how old I am, but my first job in 1972, I was 12, was in a workshop making jewellery boxes. In fact, I have one of them here somewhere. Oh, there it is. My very first job when I was a child, I was 12, I used to make these things. These are jewellery boxes. You had to paint the inside red, and I didn't put the shells in, and then varnish them and so on. And we had the radio on all the time. There were only four of us there. We had the radio on all the time. It was a tremendously important part of work. But I'm not really here to tell you about my story. again, quiz shows. Quiz shows had to be invented and then developed. This interesting one is a very, very popular BBC quiz show. It's called University Challenge. And it's teams from two universities answering questions in a rather classic quiz show style. First of all, they have general questions. And if you get the general question right, then you have a small series of specialist questions which the other team are not allowed to answer. Yeah. And they're teams from the universities. That's a fascinating idea. Now, this was invented in the 1960s when going to university for most people was wow, you know. Oh, you know my neighbour? Well, her cousin? Their son, they went to university. It was a very rare thing to do. Whereas today this is no longer the case, as you know. Yeah? When I went to university in 1979, none of my family had ever been to university. You know, it's a completely new thing. But in the 1960s it was much, much lower. And so showing clever university people on television answering questions which the people at home could not answer. To be frank, they were really, really intellectual questions. And the people who watched it were not getting the right answers to the questions. That was not the pleasure involved. And the whole question of what is the pleasure involved in watching these sorts of things is a very interesting question. Partly it's the pleasure of watching. Well, of course, you might learn a few facts. Random facts about intellectual questions is not really education, it's just kind of pretending, yeah? Of course, this is before the internet, and so before the internet, famously, somebody said to you, what was the name of that other playwright who wrote at the same time as Shakespeare? And you said, I don't know, and so you talked about something else. And today, quite often, oh, just a minute, I'll just get my telephone and Google it. And so, in fact, large aspects of education and culture have been completely transformed by that. Another example, sitcoms, that one at the top, 10 years, Till Death Do Us Part, was a moment in the development of sitcoms, and on the bottom right, Dad's Army, another moment in the development of sitcoms. Again, you can find these on YouTube, and I do recommend watching 5 or 10 minutes. You don't have time to watch them through, really. You have an aggregation to prepare. But watching 5 or 10 minutes from 1960s sitcoms, it does give you an idea of what they were doing. Although sometimes we will come back to that. And of course, soap operas, which are a very British phenomenon. Coronation Street, which is on commercial television, 9 million viewers on average today in 2021, when normally with Netflix and so on, it's very difficult to get millions and millions of viewers. And EastEnders can get up to 12 million viewers, and has been shown continually since 1985. But the form of them had to be developed, and they had a serious role. Of course, a lot of it's entertainment, and who's falling in love with who and who's going to bed with whom. But also, they will introduce regularly fairly serious social questions, not to debate them, but to explore them. So, for example, the first trans character in EastEnders, a few years ago now, 10 years ago, and it mattered to people because, of course, there are a lot of people who have a very clear idea for trans rights, and fewer people who have very clear idea against trans rights, but there are a lot of people, and certainly especially 10 years ago, there are a lot of people who just find the question worrying. And exploring it in fiction is mostly meant for people who find questions worrying, and we all find a lot of questions rather worrying. Okay, well, that's about, I don't want to move, my next section is about cultural history, but I'm not going to move on to it because it's quite long. I'm going to leave it till next time. So now is a good time to ask a final question if you wish to, and otherwise I will just wrap.